The following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, it is that time of the week. It is the best Tuesday you've had all week. And I am your host, Dave Littlejohn. Joining me today in studio, Matt Dixon. And I'm excited because I'm actually back from vacation. Yes, we don't announce it when I'm gone because that would be weird. I don't need you casing my house or something. But anyway, great trip, but also great to be back and ready to rock. And you're also missing your other microphone, Matt.
Yeah. I know. It was a hectic one today, wasn't it? We've been busy.
It was. We've had a pile going on today. Of course, it is a Tunday.
Yeah, that's what it is. We didn't get a Monday in office, so
exactly.
It kind of threw
us
into. Remember,
if you've been with us long enough, you know what a Tunday is. That's when you skip Monday. You got to cram it all into Tuesday, so your Monday and Tuesday get combined into not a Monday. And not a Tuesday, but a Tunday. It could be a Muse Day, but no, it's a Tunday.
Well, and a lot of our Tuesdays involve investment committee meetings,
yep.
Which for us, that just means we're reviewing all of the holdings. Is, you know, are positions working? Does something need to be changed?
Yep.
And so that takes up a big part of the day, too.
Right. And do keep in mind, this is me going, ready for the disclosure moment, right? The disclosure moment is when people say, wait a second, you do this every Tuesday.
Not every Tuesday.
Well,
but kind of.
Kind
we kind of do it every
so
day.
So we do this constantly. So I thought investing is long term. I said, well, it is. But one of the things that we've talked about is how position sizing is very important in managing your investments. Because we have, you know, if you've got a bunch of positions, let's say, I mean, think of if you're managing a mutual fund, which effectively what we do for the majority of our clients is we build sort of private mutual funds, right? Which doesn't make sense because mutual funds by definition are getting everybody to pool their resources together. But in this case, for our clients that have adequate assets, we are building the portfolios directly for them. And there are some advantages to that, right? Because you get things like individual cost basis. So you have some more tax control over your own holdings when you do that. Less important if you're in a retirement plan, but if you're, you know, not in a some kind of tax deferral wrapper like a IRA or a 401k, then tax control or tax management is part of the game. So anyway, the position sizing though is, well, what happens if you buy something and it doubles in size? And so, well, you know, we bought a position that's supposed to be 10% of the portfolio and now it's 20.
Well, and I think even like something that is pretty common, right? Say you buy 10% and it goes to 12. Maybe it's time, we still love the company, but maybe it's time to trim it back to that original 10%,
right, back to 10.
And take some profits and continue to hold it long term.
Well, and sometimes we'll sell the thing that was supposed to be 10%, it's grown to 12. We'll sell that and go buy the thing that fell to 8%. And because it was supposed to be 10, right? And these are all fictional percentages, but hey, we need to buy it while it's on sale, right? So we trim the thing that's sort of winning, buy the thing that's not winning, which is a little counterintuitive. But if you liked a company before and it got cheaper and you had more money, then it's an opportunity to buy it at an even better price.
Right.
Okay. So that is some of what is going on in there. And so we have to stay on top of this. Okay. So, but that's simply the novelty of cramming a lot into a Tunday.
Yes.
When you have the investment committee on a Tunday at the beginning of the month too, right? It's really the first Tuesday in September, which is the last month of Q3. Right?
That year went by quick.
It's flying, isn't it? And by the way, public congratulations, but Matt has officially 2 months or 2 years rather. You've passed the 2-year mark.
It's
August, really, but I don't think we properly credited you on air.
Yeah.
So anyway, congratulations.
I appreciate
for surviving.
That. Yes.
And it continues to add more value in the business, which we're going to talk a little bit about today. One of the points that comes up, and when I say building a team, you say, oh, it'll come back. Stay with me. Right? Stay with me. But anyhow, all of this. I don't know what. So the end of the Q3, September, historically, one of the worst months on the calendar for investors. Okay. Is that how it's going to materialize? Heck if I know anymore, right?
Right.
Because I mean, this year has just fooled me left and right in terms, and I'm glad that we didn't like bet the farm by trying to be all out of the market and get really cutesy with timing. Mm-hmm. We probably have had, in some of our portfolios, we may have had a little bit more cash in retrospect than was beneficial, but we've also had some fortunate security selection in a number of our portfolios that has sort of counterbalanced. So even though we had some cash, the holdings that we picked were pretty good market outperformers since they really lifted the whole boat or the whole tide, if you will, I guess it's the way the averages work, right? If you have 10 positions and one of them outperforms everything by 20 to 1, the whole portfolio still looks pretty good, but it's really just the one holding.
Right.
And then people go, why did you just put all the money in there? And I go, hello, diversification.
We didn't know it was going to do that. Like,
yeah, well, we hoped it would do that.
Right.
Right. But it's there's some really challenging statistics out there. And indexers love to cite these statistics about just how many stocks as a percentage of the total market underperform the market at large.
Isn't it the majority of them?
The majority. I think it's like 70% or more. I could go track the numbers down, but this was an interesting – it was a YouTube that a friend of mine was sending me, and I was kind of going through it. And they really were making the case for how indexing tends to – be a good mechanism because market timing is difficult and so many of these stocks underperform. Now, I think that indexing is really insightful considering the methodology of indexing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's probably a great topic for another show, like the methodology of indexing and how it can produce over concentration in the winners. Right, like the S&P 500 is a cap-weighted index, and as a company grows, its cap weighting grows, which means its weighting in the index grows too.
Right, and as it currently sits, like I think 5% of the or 5 companies inside of those 500 make up 20% of the index.
Yeah, it's a very very concentrated portfolio in a handful of names, which happen to be great performers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
they kind of soften the blow of the ones that are just really sucking.
Well, I always say it's the eclipse theory, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're so big, you can't see what's behind them. And
right.
So they kind of eclipse all of the underperformers by being so good that by their concentration, it just lifts the whole thing.
And it kind of makes sense, right? The big dog keeps eating the little dogs, right?
Dogs eating dogs?
Well, think about it. You know,
the
you
shark
got the,
eats the minnow.
Okay. That's probably a better analogy. But yeah, you know, you got these small companies that get acquired by the larger companies.
Exactly.
And so even if that company, you know, might fail, are they really failing or did they just get bought out by the big fish?
Yeah. So anyway, we can talk more about this. I don't think it's the topic for today, right? Today, really, when we're looking at what are our listeners interested in or who are the people that we want to talk to,
mm-hmm.
like of our listeners, I want to talk to all of you. But today, Matt, I want to have a conversation with you about how people start businesses, right? This is one of the types of clientele that we tend to specialize in. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that today, is, you know, why our firm cares. But for any of you out there, some of you, if you've recently started a business or if you are thinking about starting a business, this is becoming more and more relevant in the gig economy,
mm-hmm.
right? Where a lot of people are realizing that the traditional job landscape is changing. And so maybe you've wanted to figure out, well, maybe I'd like to do my own thing. So if you're an entrepreneur, or if you are maybe just fed up with being an employee and you never thought you were an entrepreneur, but maybe you are.
Maybe we're going to start to see more and more small businesses start up. I think about how many people kind of left the workforce when COVID hit.
No.
For those people that are starting to maybe feel the pain of inflation,
mm-hmm.
I think we might see a lot of those people gravitating towards, how do I start my own business, or what does it look like if I do this myself? Yeah. So I think this is going to pertain to a lot of listeners.
Maybe it's a side hustle.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is about trying to control, like get a different handle on your lifestyle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's just because, you know, it's a dream you've always had. Or maybe it's because you lost your job and you got to figure out how to put life back together.
So kind of start me out with this topic of kind of laying a foundation out for me and saying, what are some of the things that someone can do early on in the beginning phases of this where, you know, they get the foundation laid so that when they're starting to build the business, things start off on the right foot. Okay. What are some ideas that you might have?
So this is a really good, so.
Cause you've done it, right? You've started a business.
You've walked
this walk.
I've done this many times.
Yeah.
Both for myself, for other people. And I've blown it too.
Like, yeah.
I've had failures at this. So I could tell you sometimes it works, sometimes it happens.
Can we start there? Like, what was one of your takeaways from a business that didn't work? What was like something that you noticed that kind of was like the nail in the coffin where maybe if you could go back in time, you'd change it. Maybe you wouldn't. Or just was the foundation not right for the business that didn't turn out? Or kind of walk me through that.
So, all right. I'll give you one example. This was back in from 2006 to 2010. Had a partnership that was formed with the purpose of building small aircraft. Right?
Okay.
Two-seaters. And had an engineer, had some capital. I was sort of the program manager, the executive that's trying to pull this together. And we really did it on a shoestring budget. The thing that ultimately killed it, it was a two-part issue. One was a third party that crashed one of the prototypes.
So it wasn't even you guys. Someone made a mistake, crashed a plane, and it went up in flames.
Yeah. Now, that's literally what happened. Just so everybody can know, right? The test pilot was fine. I think he broke his thumb when he landed.
What? Well, how do you break a thumb of all
things? Control surfaces, and I think that the actual control stick was bucking pretty hard when he landed. And so I think it broke. He broke his thumb.
Was it the plane's fault or was it the pilot?
No. What happens is this was an engine manufacturer, and they put their experimental engine, and we allowed and we put it in our aircraft, and they had a gearbox that was designed to reduce the RPMs to the appropriate amount for the propeller, and the gearbox overheated and seized in flight.
Okay.
And so it lost power. They had to ditch the aircraft, and when he ditched it, it was a successful emergency landing, but they did not have any fire suppression equipment, and the aircraft, once it crashed, burned.
And you had a lot of money, I'm sure, in this plane.
About $250,000 into the plane.
Okay.
Yeah, or more. And that was really not valuing the time significantly for the build out of it. So, yes, it was very expensive, and it was really tough to overcome that because from 2006 to 2010, we also had the overall economy collapse. Right.
So just timing
really harmed us. And, competition harmed us because there was a lot of people competing in the aircraft space. This was a unique space and time where there was sort of a crack in the regulations, it was introduced on purpose, but there was this new set of regulations that allowed a real expansion of the marketplace for two-seat light aircraft. So we built one, but so did a bunch of other people. And everybody was competing, thinking that the market was going to expand and there'd be new pilots. And there weren't. Instead, it was a feeding frenzy of the handful of pilots that were around. So the companies that had the most capital survived, and probably 60 manufacturers popped up, and I don't know, 58 of them died.
I think there's a lesson to be learned in what you're just talking about here, in that, yeah, you struck out on this one business, but did that stop you from ever trying to build a business ever again?
Definitely not.
Not, yeah. I mean,
and here's the thing: a lot of it was circumstance, and mm-hmm. some of it was capital. In the end, lessons were learned. But we'll talk about this in a minute here. The business plan, other than the prototype being destroyed,
mm-hmm.
which keep in mind, it was working, right? The prototype flew. It mm-hmm. was the engine.
This reminds me of Heinz ketchup, right? Like. I don't know if you know the story, but Heinz ketchup, they were super popular when they unveiled their product. Everyone wanted ketchup. The factory burnt down, and it was either underinsured or not insured at all. He lost everything, and it's kind of a similar story, but he just was so determined to build it back because he believed in the product that he just kept going and defied all the odds.
This one,
he could have folded.
There was more market analysis that suggested even if we were successful in getting the company to survive, mm-hmm. I'll use the phrase, there wasn't enough meat on the bone, right? It was a business that was capable of keeping itself alive and keeping a few people employed, mm-hmm. but it didn't seem to be capable of developing enough margins to really be a remarkable wealth builder.
So you had a good product. That wasn't the issue.
The issue was that the market itself couldn't bear more in the end, and so we didn't fully understand the market and the capacity. We thought that these new rules would expand the number of participants, and so we would have an increase in demand, and that just didn't materialize.
That makes sense.
So anyway, it was an interesting lesson. So let's parlay this.
Okay.
We have to take our first break. We're going to come back, and we're going to talk to entrepreneurs about how might you go about starting your business and avoiding the crash and burn mistake that I experienced.
Okay.
All right.
We're ready for it.
That and more when we come back. Stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you're listening to True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, that's the music. Now we're back on.
It's time.
All right, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show, where we remind you at this break that we podcast this show.
Is that good enough? Is that sufficient?
So go to littlejohnfs.com, check it out under the Educate area or Knowledge Center. I think it's called the Knowledge Center now. And you can also subscribe to it on your favorite podcast services. So, you know, Apple and all those places that they do it. So we hope that you will do that and then tell everybody that you know about it. But today we're going to talk to our entrepreneurs or potential entrepreneurs, because maybe you don't even know it yet, but you got a dream. And we got to help you.
Okay. If they have a dream, is that good enough? Or do we need a niche?
No. All you need is a dream and you're fine. Just wing it.
I feel like
just
we're...
Just a dream and a prayer and you got this.
It's a little fluffy, David.
Okay,
I love
maybe
it.
Maybe not. So we're going to lay this out. We're going to pick this apart because we thought this was a little bit funny. Okay. So what did we do, Matt?
Yeah. Okay. So dirty confession of the day. Last week we had an awesome radio show, but I might have cheated a little bit and used AI to help me build that awesome show. Now, were we reading from a script? No. But did it give us some awesome talking points? Yes. And we may have done it again today. But you so politely pointed out, this is a framework, but it's really lacking some details and it's kind of vague. But it was just vague enough to where we wanted to talk about these points and then bring our spin to it and give you the details that you really need to know.
Yeah. So let me read through the high level of the plan, and then we're going to spend a little time unpacking this.
Okay.
And what we're going to do is try to get into more of the nitty gritty here, right? Because one of the things that AI has a problem with, first of all, it tends to answer the question that you ask it. Okay. And if you don't know the questions to ask, it doesn't know to tell you a different answer. Then the other thing, and we're starting to learn this, AI is not necessarily getting smarter.
No,
because
we've seen the exact opposite.
Yeah, the more humans interact with it, it's starting to get a learning model with all the dumb questions that we ask back to it.
Right. Well, I mean, it makes sense. If you start putting dumb humans in charge of training AI, AI is going to become more like a human. And that means you're going to become not
robot. It goes toward the lowest
robot.
Common denominator.
Exactly.
Right?
It has to. It's how it's built.
So here we go. Here's the step one of building a profitable business.
Step one.
Let's say
I'm
successful.
Ready.
This is profitable, but whatever. So step one, laying the foundation. What it says is find your niche, build a business plan, and build a strong team. Next, you need growth strategies, which means you need marketing and branding, customer acquisition and retention, and innovation and adaptation. And finally, you're going to need sustainability and profitability, which includes financial management, scaling responsibilities, and building partnerships and alliances. finally, and you can tell this is built into the radio show segments, right? There's four segments. Finally, we need some success stories and takeaways. So that includes personal growth and leadership, overcoming challenges, and a vision for the future. So to which I go, well, thanks for telling me nothing. Right? Like, what else am I supposed to say? Like, how do you build a profitable business? Well, we're going to need some unicorns and rainbows, and it'll be wonderful. Okay, let's go back to this finding your niche. That was the first thing that it says, building the foundation of your business. Find your niche.
Yeah. Well, I think that...
Can I just say before even that, like, why don't you figure out what your product is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because your niche is figuring out which customers want the product and how you're going to reach them.
And just
them.
Because it's your niche doesn't mean it's profitable, right? Like, if you
it's the
sell...
waffles thing, isn't it?
We can use the... Yeah, I used
totally
that example.
Totally got to use the waffle thing.
Well, I was going to go even worse than that.
Oh, do you go worse? I don't care.
Like, I was going to say, what if you carve little, like, mini unicorns and paint them? Like...
There's a huge market for that.
Yeah, right? Like, if you expect to become a millionaire, I don't recommend starting a unicorn carving business. Maybe it'll work, right?
It's unlikely, but I liked the waffle. So earlier we were doing some show prep because we actually thought we'd try show prep today. Novel, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Matt says to me, well, what if you want to sell waffles, but your recipe sucks?
Yeah, right? Like, you think your waffles are delicious.
That's a fair point, right? Like, everybody should love my waffles. I love my waffles, and everybody keeps going, these are terrible. I would never buy these.
Right.
And you're like, nuh-uh, they're amazing, and I'm going to make a fortune on them. And you're like, so you go out there and try to sell your terrible waffles, and you fail. They're crappy waffles. What are you supposed to do?
Right.
So,
You just because you think your niche is making waffles doesn't mean you're an actual chef.
Yes. And so that to me is, you know, step one is not just a niche, but it's like,
If there's 35 waffle houses in your zip code? Right?
You better make some really good waffles.
You better know your demographic.
Yeah. So this to me is where there is this analysis at a very simple level. It is the supply and demand analysis.
Mm-hmm.
I have a widget, a product, a service, and do I have customers?
Right.
Okay. So if you hey, I have a restaurant, but I only sell cornflakes. It's like, well, that you don't have a restaurant. Like, you sell cornflakes and anybody can get those. So probably not a viable niche.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I have a restaurant and I make, you know, Chinese food and it's amazing. Okay, you may have something there. People like amazing Chinese food, and they're, you know, if you're priced in the right spot and you got enough people in the area. Because here's the thing, Chinese restaurant in your town of 50 people, you better have a lot of freeway traffic,
mm-hmm.
or you just may not have enough people to keep paying for Chinese food. You'll still starve.
Yeah.
Right. And metaphorically, in this case, like, you'll starve because not everybody's going to eat Chinese food for every meal and pay you every time. So you just don't have enough customers.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Not a viable option.
Right.
Okay. So it's not just like find a niche. It's like, well, does your product have enough customers to begin with in the first place?
I'm going to tell a funny story for a moment. This reminds me of someone I know, and they told me that they were going to, and they were actually doing it at the time. I'm a farmer, and I'm like, oh, okay, that's great. And I started asking questions like, how many acres do you farm? And they said they had an acre.
Okay.
And I'm like, you have a spouse and two kids to feed, and you have started a business. You're in the first year of this, and you plan to be a farmer with 1 acre? Your business
doesn't seem to work.
No, no. And they were going to the local, you know, the
farmers,
thank you. Yeah, the farmers markets, and they're selling their microgreens and doing their thing, right? And I'm like, I get that that's your passion and you think it's your niche, but it's not profitable. Like,
right.
What's your goal? Okay, say you execute everything perfectly. None of your crops die. You harvest them all and you have enough buyers. Is that going to be enough sales
right.
to actually turn a profit to sustain your family. There was no business planning involved.
And so this is really the key to what you're saying too, I believe, which is this step that is sort of glossed over is where it says, you know, business planning, craft a solid business plan and set clear goals, secure funding and manage initial capital effectively. And like, again, super vague stuff here. The business plan, I'm convinced, is often misunderstood.
What do you, how do you interpret business plan?
So,
or what do you think a good business plan might look like?
I think
that's the better question.
I think a good business plan can start on the back of a napkin, first
of
all.
Oh, okay.
I think what you have is a business concept, and then you have the execution or the strategy, and that's, people often conflate the two. Let's talk about business model, and then we'll talk about business plan and business strategy. Okay.
Okay.
The business plan sort of is all of these things, but you need to know if the model is viable, meaning how much money is the business capable of earning? What are the expenses that it's going to have to endure? And is there any profit left over?
Can we just do like a TikTok Reels thing where you're hosting the show and it's napkin ideas with David Littlejohn, where we write down a business plan, you read it, and then review it in under 60 seconds. I would love to see that.
Sure. We can look into it.
All right.
Here's the fun, right? We literally own the domain name for Napkin Plan.
No, you don't.
I do.
Stop it. Stop it. This can't be real.
Concept-wise has been something that I've had in the back of my head for years. And it's the idea that a business, if you cannot understand it on the back of a napkin, has virtually zero chance of succeeding.
Mm.
Right? Now, the napkin itself is not adequate for fully explaining your business in the execution and strategy, because there's going to be complexities to it. Right? Like a napkin's not even going to explain payroll. Okay, but it can explain that my business does this thing. It has this many customers that pay this much, and it generates this much revenue. It costs this much to produce the product, and the revenue minus expenses is this number. And I can tell if it's viable with that basic math.
Okay, that's a good point to start from. I like that.
So you start with, is the business model.
Isn't it sad how many people start a business without even looking at the numbers and they realize, oh, my widget makes me 25 cents and it took me an hour to build it.
Yeah.
And it's over. But I already dumped all this money.
I'm so passionate about it. And I go, but passion doesn't pay the bills.
Right.
Okay. So the goal would be find a business. And we can talk a little bit later about this too. Like maybe the business is just not at the right scale. Right. Mm-hmm. So I need to have a way to mass produce this thing and have lots of customers. So I may have very narrow margins, Walmart, right?
Perfect
but
example.
I have massive customer base. And so I can make pennies millions and millions of times and still make a living.
It's so important to know what circle you're trying to play in.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, are you a volume person? Are you going to sell two items a year and make a living? Where are you living
at? Yeah, I mean, if you're an artist and you can paint paintings that you can sell for $100,000 and it takes you 2 months to do it.
Yep.
Well, you can sell six paintings a year and be very wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Very few people can do that.
Right.
Right. So that's the issue here. But anyway, so that's the start is, can you develop a business model that functions? And if you can, then you can talk about the strategy for how you'll do that. The strategy explains how you're going to produce it and how the expenses are going to affect it. So that's all it's really doing is, well, this is the business model. This is what it's got to do. The business plan is, how will I execute this and get it done? And in the marketing strategy, also inside of that is, how am I going to let my potential customers know about this so that they will come purchase it?
Mm-hmm.
And some marketing is word of mouth, others it's advertising and other methodologies, right? So all of that gets incorporated into the business plan, which, you know, ChatGPT sort of dismissively says, get a business plan,
mm-hmm.
right? And find a niche. And I'm like, well, no, you better know your product, know if it's viable, and then you can look at your business model. And if you got a good business model, then you can say, well, I have a business plan to explain how I can execute it. And then you need the reality check that I always tell people, right? You want to know the secret reality check to a business model?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Stick around. I'm going to make you wait until the break.
Don't do that.
Yeah, no,
David.
After the break, secret
okay.
to viable business model. We'll be right back. This is Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
You got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Just tell us we're fine. It's great. Welcome back to the True Wells Show, where, yes, you've missed the banter during the break, but it was it's
surrounding
all
parks
totally
and
relevant
recreation.
To this yeah. show today. I promised at the break we're talking about what is the secret to a healthy business model.
And to which I respond, like, you got to earn more money than you're spending.
And I'm like, that's the number one rule of finance, right? Just spend less than you make. And it works in business too. But here's the way that I tell people to make sure that your business model works. So you've gone through it, and you've pulled the napkin plan out and said, all right, well, here's how much I can earn. And then here's how much it's going to cost me to do it. And what I want you to do is now you're going to take the expenses and double them and take the revenue and cut it in half. If you still have profit in your napkin plan, there's a chance.
I love that you asterisk chance.
Right? There's a chance, not a guarantee here. Because one, it may still be a harebrained idea. And the people you surround yourself with all tell you it's great, but they're not telling you the truth because they don't want to hurt your feelings, or because you run in a very small circle of people that think it's great and the rest of the world disagrees with you.
Mm-hmm. Okay? Like if you're in West Virginia and you come up with the idea to make Mountain Dew flavored popsicles, everyone's going to love your idea because that's what you drink if you live in West Virginia. Did you know it's cheaper than water?
What?
Yeah, it's called Mountain Dew Mouth. It exists in that region because of the fact that bottled water is more expensive than Mountain Dew. And so everyone's teeth rot out.
What about tap water? That's
it's not drinkable. It's in a lot of places. It's just not good enough. And so you have to get bottled water, but water's more expensive than Mountain Dew.
This is news to me. That's news I didn't even want to hear.
Yeah, Google Mountain Dew Mouth. It's disgusting.
I want that to not be true because I feel like a Mountain Dew Mouth is also like a gateway to type 2 diabetes.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it doesn't seem like any good comes from this.
No. I don't even know how I got there. How did we get there?
Something about the double the expenses and cut the revenue in half. Somewhere in there.
We're in the weeds. Thanks, Matt.
I had West Virginia. And, yeah, you lost me there, buddy. But... the reason that I tell, it's the harebrained idea. You might be surrounded with, yes, people around you.
Oh, and yeah. Mountain Dew popsicles. There you go.
God, we got that one back. Right? We had to kind of pull it out of the fire. So the issue here, I think, with
you can't unsee it, can you?
No. See what you've done? Trying to get mentally back onto the game of the business model.
I think this was a gateway into talking about how you got to build a strong team. Maybe that's where we are going with this.
Well, that's really the next thing, right? So one, does your business model have a chance? If the answer is yes, then you go about executing on it. And then you get to the really hard stuff, which is actually running the business. And a lot of that, if it's just you, the good news is the boss may be terrible, but you know what the vacation policy is.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But once you start introducing other people into the equation, the complexities build really quick.
Okay.
Because maybe you can get contractors where you just pay them money and they are really their own provider. They're their own business.
That's the problem. There is the inconsistencies, right?
Like, well, not only that, there has to be inconsistencies, right? Mm-hmm. They have to be able to set their own hours and so forth, or you're really kind of skirting around employment rules.
Mm-hmm.
And employment laws get thick in a hurry, and you end up having attorneys that specialize in this kind of stuff because there's just that much of it. And it produces things like HR departments because of the complexities of hiring employees and navigating that process. And it's a darn shame because this is literally where the cost of regulation escalates for
business. And we live in a state where small businesses get hammered, right? Like Oregon, it's tough.
So that's one of the number one threats to small business is policy,
right?
Government policy, regulation, and so forth. Because a lot of times what happens is people just don't know what they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, I don't know what I don't know.
There's a lot of regulations, and I doubt you know all of them, but that's why you hire people to keep you out of the weeds.
Yeah, so that's why we have attorneys and other experts that we bring in, all of which has a cost. And unfortunately, all of that has to be absorbed by the business, which means it has to get priced into the business model.
And then passed on to the consumer.
And now you see where the business plan becomes more complex.
This is why I find it so funny. Everyone who's like, we need more regulations and more government intervention. And I'm like, you're paying for it, just so you know. You just highlighted how that works. It rolls downhill. We have to pay for compliance.
Right. Total side comment to this whole thing, but I'm going to throw rocks at this for a second too.
Do it.
People will often people that say we need more regulations to protect folks don't understand that what you're really doing is pricing out choice.
Yes.
Because the largest companies have the most income in order to absorb the cost of that. And what happens is they can hold their breath longer than the small companies can.
Mm-hmm.
So you throw crazy employment requirements at, let's say Walmart.
Okay. Right?
They have enough revenue as a company that they can absorb that. So the minimum wage goes up, they absorb it, price it into their business model, but the mom and pop shop gets crushed.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're gone. And then what you're left with is only Walmart.
And then so they get to control the price. If Walmart is the only place that you can buy your diapers or your food, they're going to control the price.
They're going to certainly influence, right? Because as you take more and more competition out of the marketplace, that's the byproduct.
Yep.
Okay. So this is just throwing rocks at the idea that regulations protect people, or that, well, we just need a minimum wage and everything will be okay. Well,
it's basic supply and demand. If they have all the supply and demand remains the same, they will adjust prices.
I will continue to beat this drum on this show until, I'm dragged out, which is that what a natural market needs is pricing transparency and competition. Okay. The more regulations and the less transparency we have in pricing, and this is a big problem with medicine, for example, right? Even the doctors don't know what it costs, right? A doctor doesn't know what it's going to cost when they perform a service. They have to submit it to insurance. They're going to throw some number at it for submission. Insurance is going to tell them one number, and then there's going to be an argument and a write-off. And then at the end of it all, some money will come back into the practice, and they'll have to figure that out. Hospitals are dealing with this. Private practice is dealing with this. And so that's just medicine, which we know is a giant cluster. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But every time that you take competition out of the marketplace, then what you're doing is making price discovery more complicated. That's a component of supply and demand. Like if you don't know, if price discovery is not possible, or if you have a monopoly, they set the price rather than the consumer having choice and allowing the choice to drive price.
Well, and we saw that, what was it with? Was it the EpiPens, I think?
EpiPen was a huge example where it became massive price gouging for something that was medically necessary for survival, and patents that protected a company from even being able to, for anybody else being able to get it. And, you know, of course, that guy ended up in jail.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, he did. And so that's one of those two where, you know, if you're really purist about the market, you say, well, that's just capitalism, except that the government's protecting the patent. So it's no longer pure capitalism. It's a free-ish market. This one had a government-provided moat and an exploitation of that moat.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the moat, by this, I'm saying that's the protection, right? Big companies are protected by regulation more than small companies. Small companies drown in the moat. The big companies just dig the moat bigger.
Mm.
Right. And then they ultimately make the consumer pay for it because they survive.
Then the toll fee comes into play to cross the bridge.
Exactly. So that's my issue here. And again, we're way off in the weeds, but every now and then we say something where I go, grr, you know, ethical capitalism requires pricing transparency. And it requires the understanding and knowledge that you shouldn't gouge the customer. It should be a mutually beneficial transaction. It's not pure capitalism where you're just like, I will get as much as I can from the customer. Okay. That's what sent that dude to jail.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's exploitative capitalism. I'm not a fan of that. Ethical capitalism where reasonable profits for everybody. Now that reasonable is a spectrum, right? And it's, so this ambiguous term, it's subjective in nature. So, but the ethics matter. Some people, I don't think they have any ethics at all. They're just willing to say, well, who cares? If I get mine and somebody else is dumb enough to pay me, then it's their problem. To which I would say, if that's your attitude, you're a terrible person. See a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
Good talk. Okay. now we got to get into growth strategies. And I'm like, I guess we can jam through these pretty quickly because they're so vague anyway. We got to take one more break, Matt.
All right.
We got to get our last one in here. If we do this, it'll leave us enough time to wrap up here. So
okay.
We'll do that When we come back, we're going to wrap up the vaguing AI marketing business plan. That and more. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
You got True Wealth.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, home stretch of the True Wealth Radio Show, where Matt and I are going to spend the last few minutes mocking AI's version of how to start a profitable business.
Perfect.
It'd be easier to mock if I could enunciate.
Well, you know, I've struggled with it today, too. It's a ton day. We're allowed to struggle.
It's the struggle. Is real. So the last few things, I got to go find it again. All right. So look, it was growth strategies of marketing and branding, customer acquisition, retention, and innovation and adaptation, which I think these are actually relatively, what can I say? I mean, they're actually relatively straightforward. It's just that it's such a high level that it's not terribly useful, right? Like marketing and branding, small businesses branding less important than marketing. Not going to lie, right? Mm-hmm. You are the brand when you're small. Like right now, our firm, Matt, you, me, we're the brand.
Mm-hmm.
We got a logo. We got colors. We got, you know, a branding standard and all that because we want our customers to be able to recognize when stuff's coming from us.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, like uppity, because my degree was actually in journalism and mass communications, but marketing was a component, like the creative side, not the wonky ad buying side. And to me, I like to have a corporate look and feel and voice and all those things. I think it's relevant. And our company is not just me anymore.
You like having a brand standard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, but it's really not essential to a small business, right? You are the brand. Your quality speaks for itself. How you treat your customers.
It's your name and your reputation at the end of the day that drives a lot of business.
Yeah. At the end of the day, it's always going to be that. But the customer acquisition and retention, that's part of your branding effort.
Right.
Or your marketing effort.
You want customers that are loyal and that make referrals and drive more business.
Well, and we tend to think automatically in terms of a service business because that's what we're in. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's like, well, you are the brand and you got to treat the customer.
But it
right?
could
so
work for a restaurant too. You have a great meal, you're going to tell your friends about it. And
well,
you're going to go back and you're going to eat there again.
But I would think about like locally, I think of North River, right? Now, I think they get a lot of government contracts now, but they're making high end boats, right? And they're known for quality, right? And they're a desirable upper echelon brand.
Yeah. That's why I own one. I'll just close it on here.
There you go.
Yeah.
And so, but that's the issue, right? Is that the quality speaks up, but the brand is North River. They have their logo and they have their styles and you know what they're about, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the innovation and adaptation, that simply means that, you know, at some point your product may need to evolve. This is more relevant. I mean, like tech companies, they have to constantly iterate with something new and flashy. Some things don't. Like, hey, the family recipe is just right. You don't have to change that, but you may need to change the way the business runs if you're, you know, because you got employee turnover or you want to get bigger or you want a franchise or you want just multiple locations. Like that's for a restaurant. It's going to look different for each business.
Well, you know, and I know people personally who have been successful in business and what they were able to do. They started in one arena, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they did really well. They were really good at it. But they realized that there was more money to be made in a slightly different arena, and they were just as good playing in that ball field too. And so they kind of started to transition the business into an area where they were able to serve more clients, get bigger contracts, and so they were able to adapt. And I think that's a big piece, adaptability.
This also tends to be the serial entrepreneur's MO, right? Like, hey, this thing's working pretty well, but now I'm kind of bored. I want to get back to being an entrepreneur again.
Mm-hmm.
I've suffered from this, right? I mean, I've been involved with lots of startups, and so it's always kind of interesting. I could almost go so far as to say I'm becoming a startup expert because I've done enough. I mean, I've probably been like, you know, 8 or 10 that I've been directly hands-on involved in, and probably about twice again that many that I've been indirectly involved with folks getting started.
Well, and you've done a lot of business planning for people over the years, too. That's another thing you can't undervalue.
Yeah, that's probably, if there was like a takeaway to wrap up this show on, that I would say, what could we warn entrepreneurs about? Okay, this is probably it. Do your negative due diligence.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's a really weird phrase here, but what happens is the entrepreneur has a dream and an energy and a passion. It's like, well, let's go for it. But you tend to data fit and look for everything through those rose-tinted glasses. Like, it's going to be great. Just wait and see. And what you need is some other people that are willing to be a pessimist for you if you're not. Mm-hmm. Right? If you're such a pessimist, you won't ever do it. Well, that's not a win. But being a pessimist at some point and saying, what could go wrong? And then how will I respond? You need to flesh that out in advance, because let me tell you something. When it comes to business, things will go wrong. Okay. And when they do, you need to be prepared, because if you freak out, right, you go into a fight or flight response, it's much more dangerous. So that's the biggie. Is I encourage everybody, if you're an entrepreneur, think it through. And if you got a dream and it can work, I encourage folks to go for it. But think it all the way through, not mm-hmm. just the good stuff, the bad stuff too. So, Matt,
I like it.
If folks have a dream, I will say we do business consulting within our financial planning arena. Okay, mm-hmm. It's our core business is not necessarily that, but it's something that we do really well. And if you are interested in that, let us know. You can give our office a call. We can certainly walk through a business plan with you and help. Okay, so how do they reach us?
Yeah, give us a phone call at 541-375-0898.
All right. Also, go to littlejohnfs.com and you can get all the vitals for how to reach us. But we're out of time for now. So as always, thanks everybody for tuning in. Hope it was useful. Until next time, I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you've been listening to True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
The preceding program was paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.